What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back. Welcome to the High Flyers Podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase relatable role models and their journey in work and life, including their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and much, much more to help you achieve your potential, become your best self, and continue to be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's get started.
I'm like at the stage of silo where just every day I'm sitting with PhD scientists and doing nothing but learning, right? Like I've tried in my career, you know, this kind of next stage of my career, I just want to be surrounded by people who know way more than me about things that really interest me and just learn through osmosis. I'm onboarding so much chemistry. Like, I wish I paid attention in chemistry in high school. I'm learning so much about the body and the brain and the way all of these things operate.
That's Josh Ishman, and this is episode 60. We've hit the big 6-0 thanks to you. Since the last episode, the show has received some very nice ratings and reviews, so as always, I'll be very grateful if you can go to your Apple Podcasts or Spotify app and give us 5 stars if you enjoy this show, so I can continue to have brilliant guests say yes to coming on and chatting. And Article 2 of my Curiosity Center newsletter is also live. I wrote about the power of play and who can solve more problems, MBAs, engineers, or kids. You can read and subscribe by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting our website. Now to the conversation you're about to hear with the brilliant and interesting Josh Ishman. Here are 5 key takeaways that I think you'll learn from the episode today. 1. Josh's reflections on growing up in New York and now living in Sydney, how the cultures compare and what the US was like in the early 2000s. 2. How Josh figured out what to do early in his career, specifically asked him to reflect on his first 3 years. 3. His most painful learning when he started his own company in online video. It was a meteoric rise and then the industry changed, which meant they had to pivot from a sales-led company to a tech-focused company, and his business partner went through a lot of mental struggles. 4. How and why Josh and his wife decided to create a new last name when they married. Loved the concept. 5. How Josh became an angel investor and recently started Silo, a biotech company exploring future medication based on the blueprint from traditional first-generation psychedelic molecules. And 6. Bonus. Hear Josh educate us about the types of psychedelics and why we as a society may have the wrong thinking on this topic. I love this chat and I hope you do too, so please enjoy. Josh Ishman, welcome to the show.
Hey Vidit, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. I've heard so many good things about you and just looking at your profile, you've got a very wide perspective of things, so definitely excited to get into it. We always like doing a few fun facts to give the listener a bit of perspective about you. Where were you born and where do you live now?
Yeah, I was born in New York City, raised in the suburbs of New York in a place called White Plains, and live in Sydney at the moment by the beach in Coogee.
Fantastic.
And yeah, right now I'm calling in from UNSW, overlooking the Randwick race course right now. No races going on this morning.
A great spot today. Oh, that's how good is that for a balance? New York and Sydney. I think you've got the best of two fantastic cities there. And tell me, what was your first job and what do you do now?
Yeah, so first job was working as a like computer help desk guy at a small publishing company across the street from the high school that I went to. It was basically building computers and providing software support. I remember my boss was kind of like really early on the internet. This was like late 90s. I'm old. So, I remember him telling me about his early forays into online dating, just as the internet was starting to take shape. And, it was a pretty interesting time. And I just knew that, like, you know, I love computers and technology, and so it was a great first start. Right now I'm building a company called Silo. Silo is a biotech company, and we're exploring future medications that are based on the blueprints of traditional first generation psychedelic molecules.
Fantastic. And we'll definitely get into both those things as we talk more about your journey. Now, Josh, as you know, the name of the show is The High Flyers, and we talk a lot about reimagining a high flyer. Is there a high flyer in your life that you felt hasn't got the recognition they deserve?
Yeah, I'd say for what I'm doing right now, I look back on my mom and what she did in her career as really inspiring. You know, like in my family, you know, my dad's definitely the more sort of like, you know, out there up front in the focal light personality. And my mom was a psychiatric nurse. And she worked for, you know, a clinic for 30 years, onboarding all of the pain and suffering of a number of clients, mostly children. And I mean, I just think to that now with what I'm working on in mental illness and mental health. And I'm so inspired by, you know, someone dedicating their life to helping others. And I think, you know, in my lifetime, I didn't really appreciate what she was doing as much. I kind of look back on it now, and I'm super impressed by it. And it's a huge inspiration for me.
Amazing. And that actually takes us to your sunrise, your childhood. And I was going to ask about your parents, but you sort of mentioned it already. So that's great. And you mentioned New York. So tell us about that. Tell us about what are your memories of your childhood and your environment growing up in New York?
Yeah, so I grew up in a place called White Plains. It's kind of a small city outside of New York City. So, you know, one of the good things about it is it's a 30-minute train ride to Grand Central, but also, you know, you get that suburban lifestyle that my parents were after when they left Manhattan. And yeah, quite an insular sort of very Jewish upbringing that I had. So, you know, I went to Jewish nursery school and primary school, and it was quite small. It was a super loving community. I had a very big family as well. So, you know, a number of cousins, and we would just for all the holidays get together, big family get togethers. And that was great. But I also found it quite stifling at times, just, you know, the homogeneity of it, especially because we're surrounded by such diversity, but it wasn't really a part of my day-to-day. And I ended up transferring from a Jewish school to a public school, and that was a huge sort of turning point for me. I really liked just sort of being in the melting pot. My high school and my middle school that I went to, quite diverse. And, you know, I really loved that experience. And I think, you know, from an early age, I sort of thought of myself as wanting to be an explorer, wanting to go and see different things and meet different people. And, you know, going to public school was sort of my first step in being able to do that. But I think, you know, looking back, having lived in a number of places and now as an Aussie citizen and living here in Australia, you know, I think that was quite a formative experience kind of moving into public school.
There might be listeners who think of New York as this big kind of city, hustle bustle, and I'm sure that's not quite reality as the perception seems to be. What would you say you learned from New York growing up that kind of helped you or showed you a different aspect of life? Like you said, you're now in Australia, and I'm sure you've traveled to other countries as well. Was there anything distinctive about New York or the US that early on you really appreciated?
Yeah, I mean, look, in New York, it's kind of everyone for themselves. Like, you really need to have a sense of independence because, you know, no one's kind of like laying it out for you, right? Like, it's just this huge mess, right? Like, anywhere you go, there's just swarms of people moving in every single direction. So I think, like, my initial view, like, when I think back on my early exposures to New York City, it was like, okay, have a plan, you know, have a backup plan, know where you're going, know where you're returning to. And it was just like, you know, you need to be organized because, you know, me and my friends would hop on the train and just go and wander through the East Village and just like, you know, just walk into shops and stuff. And yeah, I mean, you just kind of like, particularly in the 90s, New York was, you know, dangerous in certain parts and at certain times. So you needed to be prepared and be, you know, just be aware and understand exactly where you were, where you were headed. This was before, you know, we had these supercomputers that you could put in your pocket. So that was one of my early learnings from New York.
And who were your early influences growing up? You did mention your mum earlier and you said your dad as well. Would you say they had the biggest influence on you growing up, or was it the schooling system, or was it other people in your network?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a family of lots of powerful women, lots of female energy. So, you know, my grandmother was a huge influence on me. My aunt as well, a couple of my aunts who are just like really strong personalities. One of my aunts, who's no longer with us, I remember, you know, learning about how she went to Israel and she met a man who she then married. And I just like, that was, my mind was blown just by that alone, because, you know, all of my family, both sides of my family, originally come from Russia. You know, like my great grandparents on both sides are from Minsk and Pinsk. It's like literally, you know, origin story of my whole family is the same. They both grew up in the same sort of, you know, town outside of Manhattan called Mount Vernon. And so, like, I kind of assumed that everyone has this sort of path. Mm-hmm. And then learning that, like, wow, you could actually, like, meet someone in a whole other country and go and live there and learn a different language and get married, like, that really blew my mind. So, yeah, my Aunt Joni was a major inspiration. Yeah, I named my daughter after her, so...
Oh, wow. How amazing is that? Very cool. Very cool. And tell me, did you have any heroes growing up? Did you have any posters on the wall of any athletes or kind of public figures you looked up to?
I was a huge tennis fan. So, you know, like our whole family was really into sport, really into tennis and basketball. Like I definitely had a Patrick Ewing poster on the wall for a significant amount of time. You know, in my family, I loved Pete Sampras. My brother loved Andre Agassi. It was sort of that period, that rivalry. So yeah, we were super into sport, but more than watching, like we definitely hardcore New York Knicks fans. But we played all the time. Like we were very active in sports, and still active and trying to instill that in our family values. We, you know, our ideal kind of holiday is like just exhaust yourself with sports and activities, and then, you know, eat way too much food and just sleep.
Perfect. Tennis is great. Tennis is my, I always say tennis was my first love, and it still is. So I played tennis quite seriously growing up, but never quite had the focus and determination to carry it on. But yeah, tennis, yeah, Pete Sampras. I mean, that was the golden age for US tennis, right? I think it's sort of since then not quite been the same. I feel like Andy Roddick was probably the last big name player, and then there was a few that had potential but didn't quite live up to it. So hopefully we can bring back an American. I think just the brand American tennis players bring is, and that kind of atmosphere, I think European tennis players are a lot more controlled. Like you see Nadal, they just,
Yeah. I mean, look, if you, we just are recording right after just an amazing weekend in tennis, but Aussie tennis, right? Like Barty's win was a huge moment for our family. Like I was there with my 9-year-old watching, and like just that comeback, that celebration, like I felt like that was hugely instructive. I was very proud to be an Aussie at that moment. But you're right, American tennis is not what it once was, unfortunately.
Well, I think Jim Courier is still flying that flag for the US tennis family in Australia, and that's great. I loved his association with the Australian Open. I think it's a bit random, one could say, but I think it goes really well.
Oh, yeah. He's a great announcer. I love hearing him. It just brings me back. I was a Courier fan. Yeah, I love him.
Yeah. No, fantastic. And tell me, when you were 16, 17, and you had some understanding of the world, what was success at that age? Like, what would have made you happy in life?
Oh, God. I mean, honestly, like, that was really early days of the internet. And I think, like, at that point, my view of what I wanted to achieve was I want to be a computer programmer and, like, I want to, you know, be an entrepreneur. Those were kind of like two things that were on my mind from really early. I had it in my head that I wanted to be a person who, you know, ran companies or, you know, started my own companies and was my own boss. Like I got that template from my dad, who also was an entrepreneur and ran his own company. So like when I was applying to universities and stuff, I was applying to the engineering school. I wanted to be a computer scientist. And that's what I ended up starting with. I was accepted into a computer science program at Washington University in St. Louis. And then, I remember I took a coding class at a local community college before going to try and prepare myself. And ultimately, I found it really fun, really exciting, and extremely difficult. And I think what I learned pretty early on was that I'm a people person. I love the energy that I get from interacting with others. And, you know, I love business for that reason. You're like working with other people, you can find alignment, you can push something through to the finish line. So I ended up transferring to the business school. I maintained a minor in computer science, but I think I'm lucky that I kind of figured out pretty early on that computer science was not going to be my calling. It was going to be something that I would kind of be involved with, and having an understanding of it certainly helped.
And I would assume being in the US would be a massive benefit, because I think a lot of guests who've been on this show have talked about how they've had to move countries, or they've had to get broader experiences, particularly if you were in Australia in the early 2000s or even parts of Asia. Was I think now maybe that paradigm shifting a bit, and maybe people are going outside the US. Even the US, I think, still has that dominant influence. Did you appreciate that at that point, being in the US? Like, I mean, I know you probably wouldn't have traveled as much at that age as you have now, but at that stage, were you aware of how many opportunities you had in the US?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I did an exchange program in Sydney, actually. I studied at Sydney University for one semester in my junior year. So it would have been 2001. And I guess my early kind of thoughts on what Sydney was like at that time was that it definitely felt like there was a technological lag. Like, I actually ended up doing an internship while I was here at Fox Sports. And I remember like doing a project for them on their website design and just like, you know, the user experience. And it was atrocious, you know, and no one cared. Like, literally no one cared. They're just like, dude, we have like 10 users on this. Everyone's saying that this internet thing is going to be the future, but like, you know, we're making money on broadcast television. We don't care about the internet. I guess like one of the things that I was really sort of consumed by was the opportunities that were available to me living in the Midwest. So like, you know, I moved from New York to St. Louis, Missouri, which is where my university is based. And like WashU, phenomenal university. Like, you know, I think my undergrad business school was like 11th in the country or something. But all the opportunities for internships, for jobs after graduation, they were all, you know, big Midwestern kind of corporates, you know, like Anheuser-Busch is based in St. Louis. It's like, I don't want to work at a beer company or Monsanto, like making, you know, like patented grains and stuff like that, like genetically engineered foods. That didn't interest me at all. So I feel like towards the end of my university experience, I was like, okay, I definitely am not staying here. St. Louis is not the end goal. And like, I actually had an experience where I moved to Chicago and had to sort of like start again in terms of like building a network for career progression. Whereas, you know, like a lot of the people that I knew, they just like went straight into a job from university, but the opportunities that I saw really didn't interest me.
It's probably a good transition to go into Magic Moments, Josh, a segment that listeners enjoy the most, where we sort of unpack some of these bigger themes and then go underneath the surface. And one of the things recently that a few sort of people in the ecosystem have been asking me is they're kind of early in their career and they're trying to figure out what they should do, and you sort of alluded to that. Yeah. I wonder if you can share some of your experiences. Like, you studied computer science, now you were in the US where it was kind of boom time with a lot of opportunities. Were there any steps, I know it's in reflection now, but were there any steps you took to figure out your, let's say, the first 3 years of your professional career? And the context here being, there might be someone listening to this today who might want to take some application from that into their life. Would you have any reflections on your journey there? And then would you have any advice for listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my main recommendation is if you're interested in an area of work or study, try it out. Like what I did when I first moved to Chicago, I, you know, had this idea that I was going to build, you know, a network of bars and pubs, like an entertainment sort of empire, right? And like, I took an entrepreneurship class when I was in undergrad, and I wrote a business plan for a bar where you could pour your own beer at the table, because I had seen that once when I was traveling. And you know, I wrote this plan and I was like, I don't know what to do. I've never worked at a bar. I've never started a company. So like, I got a job at a bar. I worked at a bar for 6 months and like really quickly learned that this is not the lifestyle for me. Like staying up until 3 a.m. and like, you know, just like drinking all evening, like that is not interesting to me. All cash business. Like I was like, now I understand why this is a lot harder than it appears on the surface. So that was a big learning, was like, you know, you can try something. And then you can kind of just like, okay, I tried it. That's not for me. I feel like, you know, what I did when I moved to Chicago after, like while I was working at the bar, I was also checking out a couple of like more, you know, traditional business type jobs. I ended up getting a job at Orbitz, which is an online travel company. And right now you might look at Orbitz and it kind of seems like there's a whole bunch of other businesses that are like that, online travel agencies. And, you know, the airlines have direct connections to consumers now themselves. At the moment, or at the time, that was quite a revolutionary industry. And oh my God, the learning that I had there was just extraordinary. Like, you know, it was sort of like laying the groundwork for a lot of what now is kind of fundamental e-commerce and online, you know, user acquisition and funnel management, etc. Like we were kind of just testing that out and figuring it out for ourselves. And I was part of this really great team. And I feel like, you know, getting into something that is like such a quick moving industry, even if it's not your ideal job, but like if you feel like the learnings that you can take from there are transferable, then that's a huge win. Like, that's a great opportunity. So, and that's how it ended up being for me. I mean, the experience that I had there, like, I could take my pick of jobs after that, because, you know, everything from coding databases to like negotiating contracts, like, I got that experience at Orbitz. And then just one more to lay on there was that before taking that job, I actually ended up having the opportunity to travel and did an internship abroad. And that was an amazing opportunity. And the way I did that was I actually went to a professor that I was really close with at uni. And I said, look, I really want to live somewhere else. I want to experience a different culture. Like, do you know anyone where it's warm and where I might be able to like work for them? I don't care about money. And, you know, he opened up his Rolodex. He literally had a Rolodex of business cards, like physical business cards. And he was like, okay, like, I know this person in Thailand, this person in Malaysia, this person in Indonesia. And for me, these are places that, like, you know, I had seen on a map, but I had no idea what they were like. I was like, yes, all of those, please reach out to them. And I ended up lining up an internship in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And I lived there for 6 months. And, like, you know, the experience that I got there in terms of, like, career experience, it wasn't fantastic. But I will say that, like, just having to figure out, like, you know, getting into a groove of working in another country was hugely instructive and helpful in, like, building my career.
It all sounds very smooth sailing there, Josh. And again, a listener would be going, this sounds easy. There's no real struggle here or painful learnings. And I know that's not true. I'm sure there's many painful learnings. And we love talking about painful learnings on the show, because I think they're painful in the moment, but they're learning in hindsight, and you would have many of these. Is there one that stands out for you, whether it's in life or work, that was really painful, but you're really grateful for you going through that?
Yeah. So, I mean, let's see. In high school,
so many, right?
There's, I mean, look, I'm super fortunate that I feel like I've had a really blessed life and like a phenomenal career so far. You know, I've certainly had challenging moments. Like, I mean, my first company that I started when I was here in Australia. So, you know, after I moved to Australia, I worked with a company that got acquired by Microsoft. I was at Microsoft for a couple of years, and then me and a partner left Microsoft, started our own company in online video. And, you know, we had this meteoric rise, and then the industry changed. And we had this really, you know, this really tough time of pivoting the business from being more of like a sales led, you know, like a sales organization to being a tech company. And like, that was a very painful experience. You know, my business partner had some mental health issues, had to take some time off. We also had, you know, a legal conflict with our technology partners at that time, and it almost, you know, went to court. It was like a very messy time. And I think my learning from that experience was, like, it's never as bad as it is in your head. Like, you know, when you think about, oh my God, what if this goes pear-shaped? What if things, you know, go wrong? You know, it's always more scary in your imagination than it actually is in real life. I mean, like, I feel like during that time, there was a point in time where I was like, this is rock bottom, you know, like, I'm walking into my office on a Sunday to scan the, like, you know, we are suing you paperwork, and like, forgot my key. And I'm just like at the front door, just crying. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to go. I'm going to get my key. I'm going to scan this thing, and then I'm going to do this. And like, this is how it's, you know, it could have been way worse. Like, I still have my health. Like, we still, like, we worked through it. We ended up selling the company. It was like, we ended up having quite a storybook ending to that journey. But like, even if we didn't, I think I would look back on it and be like, that was hugely informative and a great learning experience. And, you know, it's always worse when you imagine what that sort of failure is going to be. So, yeah, I mean, my learning from that was like, take risks and, you know, the worst that happens is going to be X and, you know, you'll be better for it.
It reminds me of something a person said to me very early on in one of my interviews. He said, you don't have any scars. And I took that very personally because I felt scars. That's a bad thing. Why would I need scars? And he said, no, you need to have some failures and some knocks. And since then, I've had many as anyone has. And I think, yeah, you're spot on. It makes you understand things better. And I think just as a human, I think I've become more aware of myself as well, which is something you can't learn through courses and through success, frankly, because I think you don't have that level of hindsight when things go well. You're high-fiving everyone and you're probably drinking beers and you're celebrating and life's great. But when you have failure, you're sort of in it, like you said, you're kind of by yourself reflecting. And yeah, I think to young people, like we alluded earlier, where a lot of listeners are young, I think there is that fear, particularly in today's society, where if I fail, what am I going to do with myself? But I think I almost feel if you don't fail, you're not the best version of yourself.
Yeah. I think, like, you know, we talked about American sort of business and culture and opportunities. Like, one of the things that I do not like about the American sort of culture of business is, like, the lack of vulnerability, like exposing vulnerability. It's becoming a lot more destigmatized, but, like, you know, in startup culture, it's just like, things are great. They're always great. We're growing 10x every day. It's like, you know, actually vulnerability and honesty is so crucial in establishing credibility. Like I steer more towards say it like it is than, you know, just like smiley, happy people. And that's one of the reasons I lived in California for a couple of years and actually, like, I didn't love it. My wife liked it a lot more than I did, purely because, you know, there's this New Yorker cartoon that I always refer to, New Yorker magazine, where there's like a New Yorker going one way on the sidewalk and a Californian going the other way. And the New Yorker is saying, like, go fuck yourself. But there's a thought bubble that says, have a nice day. And the Californian is saying, have a nice day, but thinking, go fuck yourself. It's like, honesty is hugely important to me. And, like, you know, being vulnerable and being honest in your interactions, like, I find that is critical across my personal life as well as my professional life. Like, I want to have interactions that I can feel good about. And I feel like, look, I was honest with this person. They were honest with me. We had a genuine exchange of ideas and, you know, there's mutual benefit to that.
That's a fascinating topic. So I want to put a pin on that, Josh, and we'll come back to it, particularly when we talk about your angel investing experiences. I think it'll be fascinating hearing some of your observations being a outsider looking in almost. But I want to touch on family for a second. And Michael Fox, who is our mutual friend and who was on the show recently, I asked him for a couple of questions, given he knows you a lot better than I do. And he mentioned one thing interesting you did as part of your marriage with your wife, and it's to do with your last name. So I won't take the light away from your story. So can you tell us about, I think, two parts there. One, what you did with the last name, how that came about. And two, what was there a moment that led to it? Or was there a connection there with family, or did you read about it? Like, how did you get this idea to do it?
Yeah, so my wife and I have always felt really strongly about equality. Like, gender equality is hugely important to us. And like when we were kind of in the early formative days of our relationship, like we wanted to ensure that this was sort of ingrained into the fabric of our family that we were building. And so when we got married, we agreed that we would combine our last names and basically, like, create a new last name. So her surname was Amin. She's Rupal Amin. And I was Josh Islin. And we became Rupal and Josh Isman. So, I mean, it was kind of similar to the last name that we both grew up with, because like our last names are quite similar. But yeah, I mean, I can't say it was like a spontaneous thing. It was sort of something that originally we started off sort of like, it was a bit of a joke. Like I remember for our wedding, we got married in Chicago, and we had these like little tote bags made, and we had Jopalicious written on it. And that was like the name of our blog that we kept when we first moved to Australia. So we were always about like, you know, combining things and sort of turning them into some new combined entity type thing. So yeah, we ended up officially making the name change in 2011 or 12. And I guess like the rationale for it was like, I was always perplexed by the fact that when two people get married, either the female is taking the male's name, which I never felt comfortable with, or they were hyphenating their surnames, which is in effect passing on this problem to the next generation. It's like, okay, we want to be equal, but like, you know, do we want in three generations for our surname to be like, you know, a paragraph long? Like, so, you know, for me, I didn't have any like distinct connection to my surname either. It wasn't like, you know, there was, you know, this Castle Islin in, you know, some country that like, you know, is like something that where I'm carrying on the tradition. And actually it's a tradition in my family, changing your last name. So I found this out. Both my grandparents changed their last names in New York. One was to get into medical school because he had a really Jewish sounding name and you couldn't be accepted into medical school at that time with that surname. And then my grandfather on my dad's side was founding a printing business. And again, he wanted to have a surname that was, you know, kind of neutral. And so Islin was actually a Swiss name that he kind of picked out of a hat. So like, you know, my pitch to my parents was, look, like, you know, this is part of our family tradition before you, you know, like I'm keeping the tradition alive by adapting to the times and changing my last name. So
that's fantastic.
It was quite a kind of nervous situation at first because I was like, how are people going to react? Are they going to think I'm just like some weirdo? And I remember I was actually like pitching a telco at the time and I had to like, you know, change the name on the contract. And I was like, hey, I just want to tell you about this situation. I'm now Josh Isman. And like, they were like, that's so cool, man. Like, and I was just like, wow, that feels really good that people are not judging me and just saying what a weirdo.
Well, it goes back to what we spoke about earlier, right? People see your real self and your real values. And I think that really appeals to the right people and you find your right supporters. I think that's the reason I do this show. Like, to just quickly mention on that, I think a lot of people are quite apprehensive about opening up about themselves because they feel people might judge them or there might be a bit of backlash. But now doing almost 60 episodes, I'm yet to have anyone come back to me and go, I'm really sorry I said that. They actually go, I'm really thankful I said that. And I'm really glad you allowed me to say that. So I think there's a power in opening up and being comfortable with yourself. And that probably takes me to my next topic around angel investing. I think that as you'd know better than a lot of people, that's a lot about people and seeing trends. But the question I'm curious to ask you there is, and looking at your LinkedIn, you've been doing it for about 7 years in various capacities. How did you get into it? Again, I think angel investing today has become this buzzword. I hear it a lot. I'm fascinated by it. But I think for people like yourself who do it as a trade, you're not doing it for the buzz. You're doing it because you actually believe in it and you want to provide value, I'd assume. How did you start? Was there a example? Because I think the question always people wonder, and there's a big topic about at the moment, is if I don't have capital, how can I be an angel investor? Or if I'm not a senior executive, how can I be an angel investor? Like, what value can I provide? Now, you might tick those two boxes when you first started, or perhaps not. But can you give us a shed? Can you shed some light on how you started?
Yeah, I mean, when I first, like, my last company was acquired in 2015. And I exited the business in 2017. And I remember talking with a fellow founder who had sold his company to Yahoo for, you know, $400 million. I mean, he landed on a lot of cash. And I met with him in San Francisco and I said, you know, look, I want to learn about different industries, right? Like, I've been in this one industry. I've been super specialized and there's so much cool stuff going on. I want to learn about other things. And his advice was like, look, you've got some money now, like go and like, you know, learn as an investor. Like, you don't have to necessarily even write checks every time, but just like basically posing as an investor gives you opportunity to learn, exposes you to new ideas and new companies, and you can use that as a networking tool. And that was hugely informative for me. I never really thought about it that way. I thought like either you're an investor and that's like your job, you work for, I don't know, a bank or, you know, a venture capital fund or something like that, or you're an operator, like you're in a business or, you know, you're an employee, whatever. And so like I took that feedback on board and I started just networking around, like, you know, going to demo days and just reaching out to founders of companies that I thought were interesting. Like in particular, I'm a longtime vegetarian. Michael Pollan's book Omnivore's Dilemma turned me veggie in the sort of late 2000s. And so like I was hugely into and still am the potential for moving the food system away from meat, right? Or you know, away from factory farming and you know, growing meat through animals. And so, you know, I started networking in that space, going to future food conferences, hanging out at IndieBio, which is a biotech accelerator in San Francisco. And, you know, like going to demo days and just meeting companies and made a couple of investments in that space. I've also done some venture capital investing, like through funds where I knew the folks that were running it. And I guess like, at the end of the day, it's all about networking, right? Like I think LinkedIn has been the single most powerful tool in my career in like just navigating the business world and the investment world. Like, you know, I know a number of people use Twitter this way, but you can make connections with people and get into conversations that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do before that kind of a platform existed. So yeah, like another thing that I did was I joined a syndicate, which taught me a lot about sort of like investing with other people. So that was a alt protein syndicate, which is sort of a sidecar investment of investment vehicle of a alt protein fund based in the Midwest. And yeah, like I met a number of people there. I was on, you know, investment committee for a number of deals. And that gave me sort of experience on what does getting a deal over the line look like from both sides of the table? Because I'd raised money, I'd sold a company at that point, and then I kind of got some experience on the other side. And yeah, I started to also find that like there's a number of people in my circles, like even high school friends or university friends or whatever, just people in my network who were starting companies. And so, you know, when you have people that you trust, that you, you know them and they have a lot of passion and they're dedicating their life to something, I think that's like a pretty easy determinant in terms of whether you should invest. Like one of my best friends from high school ended up starting a company. I invested in it and it flopped. And I would do that investment again because it was like, you know, someone who had the determination in an area that he really believed in, that I also really believed in. The timing wasn't right. It didn't work for a number of reasons, but like, again, like I would do that investment again. I feel like if you have that conviction and you have a sort of like broad thesis, then, you know, you're more likely to get some runs.
What's the commonly given advice in the investing space that perhaps you disagree with?
I mean, there's so much about startup investing that's about, like, you know, just latching on to rocket ships. Most of my investments have been in sort of longer term plays. So, like, you know, biotech is a classic example of something that, like, you need to have patience, right? Like, you know, in order to produce cell-based meat that is comparable in price to, you know, a cow in a supermarket, like, that takes time. And so, yeah, I mean, the way I look at startup investing is quite different than I think is sort of the general way of looking at it, which is like, you know, okay, this is like something that will be liquid in 3 to 5 years. It's like, you know, oh, okay, it's a software platform that is going to, you know, change accounting or whatever it is. Like, I've generally stayed away from that kind of stuff. My thesis was more around longer term trends, and those are the types of investments that I've made. And, you know, so far they've done exceptionally well. And I'm excited to continue to invest and learn about more companies. But, like, generally, if it's like this is a get rich quick type thing, I'm not hugely interested. That's not really, like, my area of focus or what I'm really passionate about.
I'm sure if there's any founders listening to this, they'd love that. They want someone who can be with them for the long haul and be for the marathon, not for the sprint.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned LinkedIn. Looking at your LinkedIn headline, you mentioned the word repeat founder, and you mentioned at the start of this conversation that you started a company, Silo. Through a couple of conversations with people in the ecosystem, I understand you spent a lot of time exploring it, thinking about it, and then you settled on Silo. Was there an aha moment or a piece of reading that influenced you and gave you the conviction to start Silo?
Yeah, so I mentioned Michael Pollan and his book that turned me vegetarian. I'd say How to Change Your Mind, which was, you know, not his most recent book, but the one before that, was hugely instructive in my thinking around psychedelics and how they can potentially be applied towards mental illness. So, you know, I had some experience with psychedelics in my youth. I look back at that time sort of like at the end of high school, early in college, unsure of where I was going and my place in the world. And, like, I had a pretty tough time. Like, I had a really rough breakup at the end of high school that really tore me apart. And I'd say that, like, at that point, psychedelics were, you know, pretty important for me figuring out who I was. But I sort of, like, put that to the back burner and thought of it as, you know, okay, like, you know, that's sort of a childish endeavor. It's like, you know, a bit of, I wouldn't say like a recreational thing, but it's more like no longer relevant to my life because I was focused on my career and building a family, et cetera. Reading How to Change Your Mind and understanding some of the scientific applications of what psychedelics are actually doing in the brain and how they can potentially rewire a person that is effectively damaged and help heal them. That was an eye-opening experience for me. I mean, the fact that there was sort of like this industry, this you know, this whole ecosystem starting to develop around psychedelic medicine was amazing to me. I mean, like, I couldn't have dreamed that in my wildest dreams. If you would have asked me when I was, you know, 19, if that would happen, you know, that was like the height of the drug war. You know, psychedelics were seen as like Looney Tunes. And in terms of scientific exploration, like, if you were a scientist looking into psychedelics and how they interact with the brain, was like effectively career suicide. And now it's like, you know, experiencing a renaissance. So, yeah, I'd say reading that book really opened my eyes and really got me primed for doing some networking within academia to find researchers and scientists who were looking at this area and interested in collaborating. And I'd say like some of the angel investment work also helped, because a number of the alt protein investors also in like the, you know, 2019 era, looking at investing in psychedelic companies. And so, you know, they were a helpful resource in sort of figuring out the business side and what sort of opportunities were there.
And I think you mentioned earlier a point that perhaps worth unpacking is, I think psychedelics have a certain connotation attached to it. And there's a lot of unknown. I'll be the first one to admit I probably don't know anything about it. I think I feel I'd know something about it, but I definitely don't. Can you educate the listeners maybe one or two points that you've learned that you feel are the most valuable for Silo or for the broader community to understand about psychedelics?
Yeah, so there's so much out there right now in the media around psychedelics, and I'd say like broad strokes, there's sort of two strands of research happening and of interest in pop culture. One of them is the sort of microdosing approach, which is kind of like meant to be either a sort of substitute for SSRI antidepressants. So, you know, people have tried a number of different antidepressants and they still feel depressed and they hate the side effects that come with antidepressants. And so they want to try something else. They try microdosing a psychedelic. So that's like sub-perceptual dose. You know, you're not having a psychedelic trip. And, you know, there's a number of resources out there on this, but really early days in terms of the research. So there's certainly no definitive proof that psychedelics are effective as a sort of antidepressant replicant, although there are a number of anecdotal suggestions that they can be. And then one sidetrack to that is kind of like using psychedelic microdosing as a way to boost creativity. And again, not much clinical evidence that is actually true just yet, although there are some clinical trials starting to happen in that area. The other entire area of exploration is the idea of macrodosing. This is like, you know, a larger dose for someone who is experiencing severe mental illness generally. And you know, that sort of experience is like you're with a clinician for the clinical trials that are going on in this area. You're with a clinician, you meet with them beforehand. You meet with them for a session where you're in a bed wearing eye shades, you know, 6 to 8 hours going through a psychedelic trip, 1 to 2 clinicians. And then afterwards, there's sort of, you know, an integration or several integration sessions where you're talking about what you saw, unpacking your experience and trying to integrate it into your life. And there's clinical trials in the macrodosing area a lot more further advanced. So I guess like, you know, broad strokes, there's so much research happening in this area for what Silo is doing. We're actually going kind of very early in the drug development cycle where we're taking the blueprints of psychedelics and we're trying to adjust them and change them to develop next generation psychedelics. So, for example, one of the potential products that we're developing is a shorter acting version of psilocybin, which is the active molecule magic mushrooms. So, you know, that 6 to 8 hour session, what if you could make that, you know, 1 to 3 hours? Could it have the same clinical application, but, you know, maybe be more broadly applicable because, you know, you don't have to have 2 clinicians for a whole day. You could potentially do 2 dosings in one day. Hugely resource intensive, right? Another application we're looking at is a microdosing type application, but one of the sort of shortcomings of psilocybin is that it actually hits a receptor in the brain which creates a heart liability. So 5-HT2B receptor, psilocybin hits that. And so we're trying to design a version of a tryptamine molecule, which doesn't hit that receptor and which is long acting. So it could be used for subperceptual dosing. But like a lot of what you're reading about in the media around psychedelics is more clinically focused, natural products. So kind of, you know, taking psilocybin to the clinic right now, giving it to humans and seeing if it's an appropriate solution for end of life anxiety or treatment resistant depression. And that, you know, that is work that is hugely informative for us. But that's not what we're doing. We're designing new drugs.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. I feel I've learned more in those last 2 minutes than I did reading long articles trying to understand the wording and the fancy terms. So very, very intriguing. And yeah, exciting times ahead. I think we're in the start of a new year, so I'm excited to see where you get to in the next 3, 6, 8 months. Now time for the final sprint, Josh, some rapid fire questions to close us out. And hopefully you can give me 60-second answers and we'll keep it relatively short. Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life? And it doesn't have to be financial.
Oh man, my wife bought me a wetsuit for my 40th birthday that like it's such an integral part of my life. So I'm a dedicated swimmer and swimming every day is kind of like it's a non-negotiable thing. Like I sort of describe myself like a dog that needs to be walked every day. If I don't get my swim in, I'm like a train wreck. So, you know, I think that wetsuit was like one of the best investments that my family has ever made for my mental health. The other one is my Apple Watch. Like being able to go to the beach without my phone is a huge value add.
It's funny you say that because I have been seriously contemplating that. So my beach equivalent is the gym. And yeah. I take my phone and I'm not a phone addict in the gym, but I'm always attracted to my phone. Yep. And I don't have an Apple Watch because I'm not a big watch person, but I've been pondering that whether I should buy an Apple Watch just so I can look at the time and I can have some music playing but not have the negatives of a phone. So maybe you've confirmed that for me. Is there one thing you'd like to learn in the next 6 months?
Oh, God. I'm like at the stage of silo where just every day I'm sitting with PhD scientists and doing nothing but learning, right? Like I've tried in my career, you know, this kind of next stage of my career, I just want to be surrounded by people who know way more than me about things that really interest me and just learn through osmosis. I'm onboarding so much chemistry. Like I wish I paid attention in chemistry in high school. I'm learning so much about the body and the brain and the way all of these things operate. I literally wake up and I'm listening to podcasts about chemistry and neuropharmacology, and I go to bed just after writing emails and responding about the same topic. So like pretty much that's all I'm learning about right now. And I think that'll take me until the end of the year.
That's great.
So yeah, that's really the focus of learning right now.
And last one, is there one person or quote that inspires you?
Oh God, there's so many people that inspire me. I'd say, you know, the two people that inspire me the most and like I are just my go-to for listening and just like they sort of have defined my worldview are Sam Harris and Bill Maher. I wish I could experience the two of them interacting, but I don't think that is going to happen. They're kind of different worlds. Like Sam Harris's podcast, I'm a subscriber, and just like I find he's just the most articulate voice about literally anything from, you know, psychedelics to politics to pop culture to everything. I just like soak it in And it's just so informative to me and so helpful for me in interpreting this chaotic world that we live in. And then Bill Maher is just like a super outspoken, you know, unafraid to just like push the boundaries at every turn type of voice. Yeah, I don't have a quote to throw out. I guess one quote that I read recently about psychedelics was Terrence McKenna, who said that if life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness doesn't include the ability to explore our own consciousness, then the Declaration of Independence isn't worth the hemp that it was written on. so I love that quote. That's something I just read.
You probably don't need a marketing department after that. So
trust me, I do.
Yeah, fantastic. That's a great note to finish on, Josh. Thank you so much for joining me. You've got a fascinating journey and it continues, and I think some of the work you're doing is super, super impactful. So excited to see where it goes and keep in touch.
Thank you, Vidit. Appreciate you having me. Thanks a lot.
I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your lives and be 1% better every day. And I look forward to sharing the next episode with you next Tuesday. Stay tuned.